I could die, I spat out. I want to go home. Don't force my hand, Beryl. I can clear my own name by divorcing you and naming the Duke as co-respondent. You'll lose any penny you ever thought you might get from me. You'll lose Jarvis, too. Can you honestly say you're not planning to take him from me no matter what happens? He looked at me impassively. Tea things rattled just outside the door. I felt close to tears, and also hollow, as if I'd lived all of this before, many times over, with different words laid out for the same horrible crimes, for being a woman, and daring to think I could be free. But now it wasn't only my fate that lay in the balance. Come after me with all you have then, I finally said. Do your worst. What transpired next would be whispered and tattled about for decades to come, and mostly bungled in the retelling, like the nursery game of telephone operator, where even the most banal message turns tangled and foreign and unrecognizable. Some said Markham stormed the palace with a bundle of love letters from the Duke. Some insisted that his mother went, begging an audience at the royal enclosure at Ascot. Queen Mary's solicitors were woken at daybreak, or perhaps it was Sir Ulic Alexander, keeper of the privy purse. The old lady was outraged, terrified, dismissive, threatening. No one could cite a prince of the blood in a divorce petition, but she would pay to make sure it never happened all the same. £10,000, or £30,000, or £50,000, in a capital sum that would generate an annuity for the rest of my life. If I would go the hell away. Rumor and speculation took on a life of their own, and nothing that was ever said could begin to surprise me. I was too empty anyway. Jarvis went to Swiftstone, as I'd always known he would, and he made progress there. His body healed. He babbled and cooed in his lovely cot, liking his own voice. Perhaps he would remember me standing over him, tracing the small crease of flesh beneath his chin. I hoped so. He had Mansfield's eyes, while I saw nothing of myself in him. Nothing, except the way he had fought to be here, alive. Through the years I would return to Swiftstone to visit him, always watched over by Mansfield's mother and various nannies, as if they were afraid I'd run off with him to Africa. I had certainly thought about it, if only so that he would know the colours of that place, the lion-gold grass and the snow-glazed summit of Kilimanjaro, and also more truly know me. Instead, I told him stories about Njoro, about Kibii, and Bulla, and Wee McGregor. Leopard nights, elephant nights, the flat, forever sky. When I left, I always said the same thing. One day, we'll go there. I'll show you everything. Chapter 56. I stayed in England for the remainder of 1929, often going out to the Aero Club in Piccadilly. There was something soothing and even healing in watching aeroplanes stitch through the vacant blue over Shell Beach, glittering silver needles pulling thread. It was there that I ran into Dennis on a sheer October day. He had on a snug leather jacket and an aviator's scarf around his neck, and was walking towards me across the terrace cafe near one of the great hangars. I could scarcely believe it for a moment, as if I'd dreamed him. Then we rushed towards one another without any thought or awkwardness, like two people who had found each other at the end of the world. My God, it's good to see you. I gripped his hand, unable to let it go. How are you here? To get my flying hours in. The royal fiasco netted me the funds to finally buy the aeroplane I've always wanted. She's a lovely gold gypsy moth. I'll ship her back to Mombasa, if we're both still standing in 6 months. He meant him and the plane. After Maya's tragedy, I was surprised to hear him be so bold, but that was Dennis. They're beautiful machines. I looked up to where a bright de Havilland waggled and straightened again. They make me think of Grace.
You've been through the ringer, I know.
You never liked Mansfield, did you? I ventured. You were always chilly near us.
I wanted you to be happy. I've always wanted that. But it surprised me when you married him. Honestly, I always thought you were too much of a free spirit for any sort of confinement. That we were alike in that way.
Maybe that's what botched up things from the beginning. Who can say? But everything's tipped over now. I don't know what will happen to the farm or my horses. Or even what to care about saving.
You should learn to fly.
Me? I asked. Does it feel as open up there as it looks from here?
Even more.
Sounds like heaven, then, I told him. Save some of it for me. Over the next few weeks, until I left for home, Dennis and I met every day for lunch at the aerodrome, in sun or rain. I was as drawn to him as I'd ever been, and though part of me was longing to kiss and hold him near, it also felt wrong to have these desires, when Jarvis was still so vulnerable, and the wreckage of my marriage smoked in pieces around me. But Dennis was my friend, too, and I needed one. He told me everything he was learning in the air, and I fell on each detail, happy to have something new to think about. It does seem like pure freedom, I told him. If you can forget about the risk, that is. The fear never completely goes away. It makes everything sharper. I nodded, understanding exactly what he meant. Even as a child, I'd had it in me to test and challenge myself. Though I had sometimes forgotten that girl, she came back clearly when I looked into the sky. So sharp and blue, it was a sort of window. Maybe I would fly, too. Maybe that's why Dennis and I had had these days together at the aerodrome, and why I had begun to feel less low and desperate. The idea of it, of a future with wings, made the truest sort of sense, and began to cure me. Dennis did, too. Just sitting near him helped me remember who I was in better times, stronger and surer, ready to look ahead, to face what came next without fear. Have you ever imagined us together? I asked him one day. A time or place, a world even, where we could be together. Simply, I mean, without trying to ruin one another, or wanting more than the other could give. His smile came slowly. His hazel eyes, when I looked into them, were bottomless. What about this place? This moment? He reached for my hand, and we sat like that, side by side, for a few more precious minutes, while over our heads a silver moth glinted like starfire, and dipped its wings sideways, and passed behind a cloud. Chapter 57. At the end of March, 1930, I sailed home. I went briefly to Malela to see my father and Ruta, and our horses. It was harder than I ever imagined to find words to explain that Jarvis was still in England, that they might never even meet him. My father wanted to go after Mansfield, as if we could spar across an ocean and change anything. Ruta was quieter, and also terribly sad for me, I knew. He seemed to guess immediately that the farm had lost its bloom. I don't have the heart for racing just now, I told him. I can't seem to think about anything from the old days. I don't want to sit on a horse, and I don't want to smell the paddock. I'm going to learn to fly,
I see, he said, and was quiet for a moment. And where will we go for this flying? The word we nearly did me in, filling me full of tender holes. How about Nairobi? We moved to the Mudega Club, where I rented Dennis's old cottage, and Ruta and his family found a house in the native quarter nearby. The sight of Asis running alongside his mother, or clambering into Ruta's arms, had me missing Java so much, it was often almost enough to double me over. According to Mansfield's letters, he was still fragile, but getting stronger all the time. Along with news, Mansfield had also begun sending a small allowance. Though he had been aggressive with threats of divorce when I was still in London, now he dragged his heels on the actual proceedings. But it didn't matter. He would see things through when he was ready. And I found I didn't champ at the bit to be fully free of him the way I had when things were so impossible with Jock. I was a mother, but couldn't hold my child in my arms. Freedom didn't mean the same thing that it had before. Nothing did. One day Karen came to my cottage for drinks, and I was surprised to learn she'd been in England too, just past the time of my well-publicized tangle with the Markhams and the monarchy. I can't imagine how awful it all was, she said. I'd told her a little about Mansfield and Jarvis, but kept the most painful details to myself. I'm not the only supposed courtesan on Fleet Street. Some other girl will come along soon, and everyone will forget about me. If that was a wager, I wouldn't take it. She sighed and touched her drink to her lips, her gaze turning inwards for a moment. While you were away, I had locusts at the farm, and then frost. Everything withered. It's why I went over, to see if there was any way Dennis could help save me from my debts. And was there? No, she said quietly. He's promised to take me flying, though, when he returns. The princes are coming back for more safaris, too, though no doubt you already know that. David needs his lion. Naturally, she said bitterly. It's not all terrible. You know how much Dennis has wanted his plane. Yes, and now there are more clients groveling to throw in with him than he could ever accommodate. I should be happy for him, shouldn't I? And yet I'm afraid it will ruin us. Her eyes were lined and impenetrable. I had no idea if she was sharing the truth with me, that she and Dennis were near the end, or spinning out a dramatic story. I wasn't sure how their unfolding drama affected me, either. But it did. Dennis returned a few months later, and began to make arrangements for the prince's next visit. I didn't see him at first, but heard from Cocky that he was planning to move into town from Ngong. Tanya has given back his ring, she told me when we met in town for lunch. Apparently the separation is mutual, but that doesn't mean it's not killing her. What do you suppose finally broke them? She wanted more than he's capable of. That's no one's fault. They both tried as hard as they could, didn't they? I paused, trying to find words for my tangled feelings. We can only go to the limits of ourselves. I've learned that, if nothing else. Anything more, and we give too much away. Then we're not good for anyone. She may have to sell the farm, you know. After everything, and all her fighting for it. She's been undeniably brave. She's been a warrior, I agreed. And she had. For nearly 2 decades, Karen had set her complete self on the line, gambling against impossible odds, mortgaging everything, loving her land too much to let it fail. And yet it would fail. I could scarcely imagine Ngong or Kenya without her. The only happy thing I can think of is that you have Blix finally. Was it worth everything you went through to win him? I don't know. She twisted the ring on her finger, a square yellow diamond, bright as the sun. I'm not sure it matters anyway. I couldn't have made any other choice. He is my heart. Do you know what I mean? Yes, I told her. I think I do. I was reading in bed a few nights later, in my cottage, when Dennis came rapping on the door. I knew it was him before I answered. I'd been waiting for weeks, for years, but this time I knew he'd come. Throwing on my dressing gown, I turned up the lamp and poured us each a generous glass of scotch. Even tired and unshaven, with a nasty scrape along the back of one arm, he looked like a piece of heaven to me. We sat without speaking for a long time, until I thought that it almost didn't matter what we found words for or didn't. His breathing steadied me. The rise and fall of his chest, the soft creaking of the chair under his weight, and his fine, rounded fingers locking around the base of the glass. "How's your aeroplane?" I finally asked. "Perfect. I'd no idea I'd love it so much. And it could help business, too. The last time I was up, I spotted 3 different herds of elephants, 4 massive bulls. For numbers like that, I could be out for weeks, drive hundreds of miles." "What? Scout for them from the air, then? And wire ahead to camp?" He nodded. "Not bad, right?" "Not bad," I smiled. We fell quiet again, listening to the sounds of the insects in the grass and the jacaranda. "I heard Karen may have to sell her farm," I told him. "She's looking at the very darkest side of things. I'm worried about her, but she's asked me not to visit. If we don't keep our distance now, we might just lose everything, even our lovely memories." I set down my drink and went to him, resting my knees in front of his chair and taking his hands. "I have so much respect for her, you know. She's the most remarkable woman." "Yes." He looked at me carefully, almost solemnly, as if he were trying to read my features like an ancient text. The lamp threw a dark wand over part of his face, but his eyes gleamed, soft and amber-colored. They reminded me of Barclay's Falernian wine, of lions in the grass. "Will you teach me to fly?"
"I couldn't take your life in my hands, not when I've just got the hang of it myself."
He said nothing of his own life, or of Maya Carberry's, how her plane had smoked and steamed on the Ngong Road for hours, keeping the authorities from even trying to recover her and Dudley's remains. I wouldn't have expected him to. "I'm going to do it anyway."
"Good. I'll be back in 3 months," he said. "We'll go up, and you can show me everything you've learned. We'll head over to the coast, or out on safari together." We never did get those 6 days, did we?
I thought of Pegasus, and the elephants, and the dissolving bridge, of Dennis's boy running 20 miles in bare feet to break my heart. No, we didn't. Chapter 58. A great deal had happened to Tom Campbell Black since the day we met by the side of the road in Molo. He'd got the aeroplane he'd dreamed of, and learned to master it, becoming the managing director and chief pilot at Wilson Airways in Nairobi, a spanking new flying operation that ferried paying passengers and did courier work. He had also recently made the headlines by rescuing a world-famous German war pilot, Ernst Udet, whose plane had gone down in the desert. When I searched him out to ask about lessons, he didn't seem at all surprised to see me again, saying,
"I always knew you were going to fly. I could see it in the stars."
"I see. So that's why you made a long, grand speech about aeroplanes and freedom and the clouds and nothing holding you back? That was all for me?"
"What? Don't I look like a mystic?
As long as you agree to teach me, I said, laughing, you can be as mysterious as you like.
We began in the early morning over a peacefully sleeping Nairobi. The aerodrome was as ramshackle then as the town of Nairobi had been only 30 years before, tin and glass and hope standing tiptoe at the edge of emptiness. Tom had never had a student before, but in a way that didn't matter. Most of flying was instinct and intuition, with a few do-or-die rules thrown in on top. Trust your compass was one of these. Your own judgment will go haywire sometimes. The horizon will lie to you too, when you can see it. It's bound to. But this needle, he pointed with no small drama, this will tell you where you should be going, not where you are. Put your faith there, and you'll catch up eventually.
The plane we used was set up for dual instruction. I could learn the instruments and the feel of the rudder bar with him on hand to catch my mistakes. There were earphones we could use to talk to each other, but soon Tom stopped wanting to use them.
You're going to have to find out where you're misstepping on your own, he told me. I can keep correcting you, but what would be the point?
He was right, of course. The throttle, the angle of the joystick, the tail skid and wing flaps and elevators, each element needed to become something I could feel and know, and even fail at occasionally, especially at the beginning. Sometimes the moth's weight sagged, and she lost altitude, dropping towards the sun-bleached grass and the rocks, everything hurtling at great speed. There were unpredictable downdrafts near the mountains. The propeller could sputter out as quick as a breath, or weather could come up from nowhere. You could land in San Severia, ripping your wings to tatters, or sideslip and crack the undercarriage. You could hit buried roots or clods, or the deep snag of a pig hole, and bust the struts, grounding yourself, or worse. You could practice and practice and read all the signs correctly, and still founder. And yet the challenges felt exactly right to me. They brought me alive in a way I hadn't felt in a very long time.
I want my B-class license, I told Dennis when he came back to town. I could be the only professional female pilot in Africa.
You don't want much, he laughed. But you broke the same sort of new territory as a trainer, didn't you?
I suppose so. This feels different, though. It's just you and your instincts up there, isn't it? The challenge of that feels new every time. I was quiet for a while, and then felt my way towards something I'd only just begun to realize. After what happened with Jarvis, I began to wonder if I'd ever find my way again.
You'll see your son soon, he said softly. Mansfield can't fend you off forever.
I won't let him. I would never give up on Jarvis, the way my mother did me. I couldn't.
Sometimes when you're hurting, it helps to throw yourself at something that will take your weight.
I nodded.
Just promise me you'll be careful when you fly.
I promise, I said. You know, Ruta has made the leap without a hitch somehow. He seems as exhilarated by the whole business as I am, and Tom says he has the makings of a damn fine mechanic. The sun had set, and I lit the hurricane lamp while Dennis dug a book out of his satchel and then stretched out in a chair, his long legs crossed. He read aloud to me as I curled next to him, both of our bodies in a warm arc of light. For nearly 10 years I'd wanted this. This exactly. Is he really here? I thought. Am I? Dennis read on, his voice rising and falling, while a leopard moth that had got caught in the curtains stopped struggling for a moment and realized it was free.
Chapter 59. Dennis was between safaris, and there was a window, a very small one, for the two of us to go out alone. We made for southern Maasai land,
aiming at the Mara River with a team of Africans, including Dennis's man, Vilea, and a Kikuyu boy, Kamau, he often travelled with. It was impossibly dry, and yet past Lake Province we saw countless animals, buffalo and rhino and shaggy lion, gazelles of every shade and variety. The golden slopes and shimmering flatlands swarmed with life. Dennis was most himself in wild places. Through a pair of smudgy field glasses, he could gauge a set of kudu horns or the weight of still-hanging ivory. He knew how to shoot anything, with no miscalculation, and could skin an animal so quickly and with such precision there was almost no blood in it. But he was just as keen not to shoot or kill, not if he didn't have to, using his camera instead. Photographic safaris were a new idea then, and he believed cameras had the power to change hunting, the sporting idea of it. Hunters could have Africa without taking any of it away, without ruining it. On safari, I saw Dennis in sharper relief than I ever had. He had an infallible compass, and a way of seeing everything as if he knew it would never be there exactly the same again. More than anyone I'd known, Dennis understood how nothing ever holds still for us, or should. The trick is learning to take things as they come, and fully, too, with no resistance or fear, not trying to grip them too tightly or make them bend. I knew all this from my Larkwaite days, but being with him helped me remember it, and feel it all again, powerfully. For most of a day, we walked through alkali flats, the white crust, like a frosted layer of salt, that rose in a powder when your boots punched through. We wore the chalk on us everywhere, up to our knees, in the creases of our fingers clenching the rifle strap, down in the cavity between my breasts, and in my mouth, too. I couldn't keep it out, and stopped trying. I couldn't keep anything out, I realized. And that was something I loved about Africa. The way it got at you, from the outside in, and never let up, and never let you go. Dennis was happy and cheerful all day, though he'd drunk most of the fifth of gin we'd shared the night before. It was a mystery to me, how he threw it off. His blood must have been thick indeed, for it carried enough malaria to sink an ox, and yet he never fevered and never went down. The sun was an anvil on the top of my head, shoulders and neck, where fresh sweat poured and wetted my collar. My clothes hung on me, the wet salt from my body drying in rings. I was breathing hard, and hearing my own breath rise raggedly. But we had our distance to cover. What was tiredness? The porters moved ahead in a line, and when my vision blurred, the slim lines of their bodies against the great whiteness of the plain looked like human geometry. Limbs became sticks and sharp dashes, an equation of simple perseverance. Just past midday, we stopped and rested in the muddled shade beneath the great baobab tree. It was squat and wide, with ribboning, undulating bark, like a skirt of some sort, or like wings. This one hung with fruit in pale brown drooping pods, and with the baboons feasting on them. Several sat on a branch over our heads, and we could hear them cracking open the fruit, a musical rattle like maracas. A rain of the powdery meat fell on the ground around us, into the short yellow grass, and stray spat seeds too, and baboon droppings, which smelled foul. "We could move off," Dennis said when I grimaced, "or shoot them." I knew he wasn't serious about the shooting and joked. Not on my account. I could probably lie down in the shit and drop off to sleep this minute. He laughed. The physical effort changes you. You grow a tougher skin. Mine was pretty tough to begin with. Yes, I knew that straight away. I looked at him, wondering what else he'd felt when we first met. If he had sensed a jangling of recognition as I had, the sharp and familiar tolling of a bell, as if we were meant to know each other. Did you ever imagine we might somehow end up here?
Under this terrible tree?
He laughed. I'm not sure, he said, as more dusty powder fell around us from above. But I could grow to like it. By evening, we'd reached the river and set up camp. We ate a young kudu that Dennis had shot and skinned that morning, and then drank our coffee, staring into the fire as it snapped and spiraled, purplish smoke rising.
Tanya chased off a pair of lions once with only a rawhide whip, he said. She and Blix were on a cattle drive. He'd gone off to shoot something for their dinner when there was a loud commotion among the cattle. The porters scattered like mice, and it was only poor Tanya standing there while each of the lions climbed up on the backs of their quarry. The rifles were packed away in the trunks, ridiculously enough.
So she whipped them away? That was brave of her.
Yes, she has even more courage than you'd think.
We had been careful lately not to speak too much of Karen, for the farm had been sold, and it was clear she was going away. You have plenty of reasons to love her, I ventured.
And admire her, he said.
Even better, for my money.
I would never have made her a good husband, though. She must have known that deep down.
It's funny what we fight for, even when we know it's impossible. Did she manage to save the oxen?
One, yes. The other they ate for dinner, when Blix came back, empty-handed.
It all worked out neatly then.
That time, yes.
From far off, we heard the high, monkey-like chirping of hyenas, the laughing you hear tell of, though it's always sounded slightly mournful to me. The smoke billowed in a surge, as if it were trying to call out too, to the horizon perhaps, or the just stirring stars.
It wouldn't be such a bad life, you know, to be a lion, Dennis said. The whole of Africa is his buffet. He takes what he wants, when he wants, without overexerting himself.
He has a wife too, though, doesn't he? It wasn't a question.
One wife at a time, he clarified.
Then, while the fire rose and smoked and threatened to singe our feet, he spoke out Walt Whitman, because I asked him to. He said the words to me, and to the stars, while I grew more and more still. I was thinking about how I had struggled and strained for years, as Karen had, and towards things that were disastrous for me. And yet maybe that was unavoidable. The pilgrims and the lost often did look the same, as Dennis had once told me, and it was possible everyone ended up in the same place, no matter which path we took, or how often we fell to our knees, undoubtedly wiser for all of it. Barely seeming to move, Dennis reached for my hand. With aching slowness, he traced the fine bones and lines and ridges, the thickened flesh where I'd worked and worked. I thought of Karen with the rawhide whip. She was incomparably strong and courageous under her scarves and powder, her goblets and crystal and chintz. We had done a painful dance and lost a lot, we three, hurting one another and ourselves. But extraordinary things had happened, too. I would never forget any of them. I think we sat like that for hours, long enough for me to feel my own density settle more and more completely into the chalky dust. Eons had made it, out of dissolving mountains, out of endlessly rocking metamorphosis. The things of the world knew so much more than we did, and lived them more truly. The thorn trees had no grief or fear. The constellations didn't fight or hold themselves back, nor did the translucent hook of the moon. Everything was momentary and endless. This time with Dennis would fade, and it would last forever. "What are you thinking?" he asked me. just of how much you've changed me. I felt his lips on my neck, his breath. This is why there is poetry, I said, so softly I wasn't sure he could hear me. For days like these. Chapter 60. Though I knew full well to expect it, I felt my stomach twist and my knees go soft to see Karen's lovely furniture on the lawn and her books in crates. She was selling nearly everything, or giving it away, and I wrestled with the deep physical memory of watching Green Hills go, piece by piece, just like this, while I looked on helplessly. Now that her land would go to others, she was trying to find a protected parcel for the Kikuyu, who had been squatting on her property, so that they would have something for themselves that wouldn't be taken away later. I found her wringing her hands over them and smoking, pacing a circle around her things. "Now you have come too," she said. "So many visits and farewells, I don't have any tears left for them." Her white dress was loose around her breasts and legs, her straw hat abandoned on a chair. She looked young to me, suddenly. "I could cry for you," I said. "It wouldn't take much." "Did you hear they're going to hold an engoma in my honor?" She waved away blue smoke. "Won't that be something?" "There won't be a dinner, though, like the one we had when the princes were here. All my things are crated." "I'm sure it will be wonderful all the same. They mean to celebrate you. You've made such an impression, and no one will soon forget you." "I've been dreaming about Denmark lately, and of standing on the bow of a great hulking ship, watching Africa grow smaller and smaller. I hope you can come back one day. Who has the privilege of knowing what's possible, or the burden for that matter? I can tell you, though, that I never thought I could leave. I think that's what the dreams mean. I'm not leaving Africa, but slowly, ever so slowly, Africa has begun to seep out of me." I felt my throat constrict and swallowed against the knot. Her millstone table had been pulled out to the edge of the veranda. I'd always thought of it as the heart of Borgarni. The old granite was freckled and pitted, and had borne how many brandy snifters or cups of tea, all her finery, the Sèvres and Limoges, Dennis's large feet, and his books, and his hands. It was where she'd sat 1,000 times, lighting a cigarette, shaking the match, and looking off into a middle distance, collecting herself, gathering her wool scarf around her shoulders, preparing to speak. It felt strange to be here with Karen and her vanishing farm, after all that had happened, the things that had drawn us together and pushed us apart. But the truth was, it would have been even stranger not to come. We sat down in two low rattan chairs, looking up at the five-knuckled hills of the Ngong. "They say you're learning to fly," Karen said. "Yes, it's been such an important thing, and it's made me so happy." "You're 28? I nodded. "That's the age I was when I sailed for Kenya to marry Bloor. How our lives turn and turn. Things come that we never would have predicted for ourselves or even guessed at. And yet they change us forever." She trailed her fingers in the grass, back and forth lightly and soundlessly. "I always wanted wings myself, you know, perhaps more than anything else. When Dennis took me up the first time, we skimmed down over my hills, and then onto Lake Nakuru, where thousands of zebras scattered under the shadow we made. It's the clearest feeling of freedom, isn't it?" I asked her. "Yes, but real clarity, too," I thought.
Now I see. Only now. From that great height, all sorts of things that have been hidden show themselves. Even terrible things have a beauty and a shape. She caught my gaze with her black, black irises and held it. You know, Beryl, you'll never truly have Dennis. Not any more than I did. He can't belong to anyone. My heart dropped then. Oh, Karen. I reached for words, but they weren't anywhere to be found. I suppose I always knew you loved him, but kept it from myself for a long time. Perhaps you did, too. It felt so awful, hearing her strip the veil from years and years, and yet also necessary. We should be telling the truth to each other, I thought. We've earned that, if nothing else. I didn't mean to take anything from you, I finally said. And you haven't. No, it's the gods who are punishing me for wanting too much. She looked up at her hills again, and then around at her things on the lawn. Such happiness always comes with a price, and yet I would pay it all again and more. I wouldn't take a single moment back, not even to save myself pain. You're the strongest woman I know, I told her. I'm going to miss you. Then I leaned to kiss her on the cheek, just where her tears had come, to blur the powder. Chapter 61. How our lives turn and turn. Dennis was meant to come for me and fly us down the coast to Takangu. On the way home, we'd test his theory and try to spot a few herds of elephants near Voi and alert some waiting hunting friends with a cable. It was early May. I told Ruta I was going, and then Tom, whom I found at the Wilson Airways hangar, scribbling figures into his flight log. But we have a lesson tomorrow. Can't we postpone? He looked at me, and then out through the door of the hangar, where scudding clouds tattered the pale blue of the sky. Don't go, all right? What is it? Do you have one of your mysterious feelings? Maybe I do. There's always another day, isn't there? I didn't want to give up the trip for a vague premonition, but Tom was a wonderful teacher, and I trusted him. He also rarely asked anything of me. So I went back to my cottage at the Mutega, and Dennis left for Voi. I learned later that he'd also asked Karen to go with him, before he'd asked me. But that morning his only passenger was his Kikuyu boy, Kamau. They took off in glorious weather, and were out for several days before flying to the foot of Mbolo Hill, where his friend Vernon Cole lived. Vernon was the district commissioner. He had a young son, John, who was transfixed by Dennis, and his wife, Hilda, was newly pregnant with a second child. They made Dennis a lavish dinner and listened to him talk about the elephants he'd scouted from above, just as he'd suspected. There they were, bold as you please, just browsing along the river. Weeks of scouting cut out in moments, only moments. The next morning at dawn, Dennis and Kamau took off again, this time for home. Hilda gave them a bushel of thick-skinned Kenyan oranges to take along. Kamau held them in his lap as the propeller swung to life and the moth's engine fluttered, coaxed by Dennis's fingertips on the throttle. He took her up quickly and circled twice before sailing out of sight. In Dennis's cottage, I was sleeping, dreaming of nothing. Ruta woke me with a knock at my door. Have you heard from Beda? No, I answered sleepily. Why would I? I don't know,
he said. But he had guessed at something. Felt it. As Tom had. Waving once, the moth's custard yellow wings sheared away and dropped out of sight. Dennis had named his plane Nzige, which meant locust, light as the wind, agile and imperturbable. The wonderful machine should have gone on forever. And Dennis, too. But a mile north, for no reason that anyone would ever be able to confirm. His plane spun in at low altitude. He may have broken a crucial cable or mishandled the wind shear somehow. Perhaps he maneuvered too sharply at too low a speed or lost control of her in any number of ways. All anyone would know was that he met the earth almost vertically, hurtling into the rocky soil near Mwakangali Hill and exploding on impact, bursting into flame. When the coals traced Dennis's smoke to the site, there was almost nothing left of his body or the boy's. The moth was a ruin. Only a handful of blackened oranges spilled over the charred ground, and a slim volume of poetry that had been thrown from the wreckage, fluttering with bits of ash. In shock, Hilda Cole dropped to her knees and bent double. Later that afternoon she would miscarry her baby. And that's how three came to die that day at Foy. Three souls perished. And none of them mine. Chapter 62. Karen buried Dennis on the farm, as she knew he wanted it, at the crest of Lamwia, along the Ngong Ridge. The spot lay at the top of a steep incline, and the coffin bearers struggled to get there, stumbling with the heavy box. Karen walked ahead and stood nearest the open hole, red as a wound, when they lowered him in. I was entirely numb from the inside out, unable to speak to her or anyone. The day was shockingly clear. Below the ridge, the coppery slope rolled onto the plains. A pale stretch of road stood out like rope that had been tossed down from the clouds, or like a snake that went on ceaselessly all the way to Kilimanjaro. Around the site of Dennis's grave, the grasses were lush and living. Plaited through them were two dark forms, the shadows of a pair of eagles, drifting above us in ever-widening circles. Mourners had come from Nairobi, and Gilgil, Eldoret, and Naivasha, Somalis and Kikuyus, and white Highlanders, hunters and gun-bearers, pilgrims and poets. No one there hadn't seen something to love and admire in Dennis. He had always been unflinchingly himself, and honorable for that, in the way these eagles were honorable, and the grass, too. During the brief service, Karen's head sagged to her chest, and I felt a strong urge to go to her. I was the one person there who knew precisely what she'd lost in Dennis. She was the only one who could have understood the weight and color of my sorrow, too. But a shift had taken place, and it held me back. She was his publicly acknowledged widow now. The gods may have stolen him from her, but with his death, she had won him back. No one could challenge their bond, or doubt how she had loved him, or how truly he'd been hers. One day she was going to write about him, write him in such a way that would seal the two of them together forever. And from those pages, I would be absent. I didn't think I could weep anymore, that like Karen, I had spent a lifetime's worth of tears. But somehow my grief found a way to open wider that day. When the service was over, and the mourners had gone down over the hill to Borgani, I lingered long enough to reach for a handful of dust from Dennis's gravesite, red as life's blood, and older than time. I closed my fingers around its powdery coolness, and then let it go. In a way, it didn't matter if there was something proprietary in Karen's sadness, or in how she had loved Dennis. I hadn't loved him any more perfectly, and I understood that, finally. We had both tried for the sun, and had fallen, lurching to earth again, tasting melted wax and sorrow. Dennis wasn't hers, or mine. He belonged to no one, and never had. After Dennis's funeral, I went back to his cottage, where I'd been living, but the sight of his books nearly undid me. It was shocking to think how his mind simply wasn't in the world any longer. I would never hear his laugh, or touch his fine, strong hands, or trace the crinkles around his eyes. When he fell out of the sky, everything he was and would yet do had vanished, and had taken my heart with him, too. How would I get it back again? I couldn't think of what I might do with my days, or where I might go, but somehow found myself back in Elbergen, at Melela. My father seemed surprised to see me, but didn't ask any terrible questions. I couldn't have begun to answer them if he had. I only wanted to be alone, and to be near horses, two things that had always soothed my soul in the past. For weeks I stayed, waking before dawn, and striding out into the cold morning to think. The colors of the country were beautifully the same. Mist hung stretched over the towering cedars in the forest, and the ragged curve of the escarpment rose and receded off towards forever. But something was missing. For all its beauty, Melela now seemed to mock me. I'd pinned so many dreams on it, believing that if Mansfield and I could rebuild the green hills here, rewriting the sad changes of the past, some part of me would feel reclaimed and strong, in a way it hadn't, not really, since I was a young girl, hunting with Arap Maina, running with Kibi through the tall bleached grasses, slipping out of the window of my hut with Buller at my heels, both of us unafraid of the night. But all Mansfield and I had truly managed to do was humiliate each other, and ourselves, and to carve great big holes in one another. Jarvis was a world away. Some days I could barely stand to think of him. And now Dennis was gone, too. One crushing loss lay like a black stamp over the other, a shadow smothering a shadow. Emptiness, and more emptiness. And what could be done? My father was worried about me, I could see that, but nothing seemed to help, until one day, when I heard a familiar sputtering sound echoing through the hills, and there was Tom's moth, waggling its way towards the farm through pure and cloudless blue. Using our long paddock as a makeshift runway, he set it down like a feather. "How have you been?" he asked, after he'd cut the engine and clambered out over the wing. "Oh, you know." I felt myself give way, and couldn't manage another word. But I didn't have to. Tom handed me a flight helmet, and I lowered myself into the rear cockpit, grateful for the sound of the engine rattling to life, the vibration of my small seat, everything shudderingly present as we came to speed. When we roared up over the hills, and the landscape slid sideways and reeled away, my head began to clear, for the first time in weeks. Cold air swept against my face and filled my lungs. It was so much easier to breathe up there, and even with the constant noise of the prop and the wind, it was peaceful in a way my wounded spirit had been craving. I remembered how once a native boy had asked me if I could see God from the aeroplane. Tom was there,
and we had both laughed and shook our heads. "Perhaps you should go higher then," he said. Tom kept us up for a good long time, tracing a wide circle over our valley, towards Njoro to the east and Molo to the north. The tip of the wing was like a bright, silvering wand. Watching it, I felt a whisper of hope and something like redemption. It wasn't God I saw at this height, but my Rift Valley. It stretched in every direction like a map of my own life. Here were Karen's hills, the flat shimmer of Nakuru in the distance, the high, ragged lip of the escarpment, white-bellied birds and red dust. Everything I'd lived through lay unfurled below me, every secret and scar, where I'd learned to hunt and jump and ride like the wind, where I had been devoured a little by a good lion, where Arap Maina had stooped to point at a cloverleaf-shaped print in the drying mud, saying, "Tell me what you see, Lark Wait." This valley was more than my home. It beat in me, like the drum of my own heart. Only when we needed fuel did we make our way back to Malela. Tom stayed to dinner, and because he would fly out again at dawn, took himself off to bed early, while my father and I stayed up with hot, bitter coffee. There wasn't any sound in the room, just low light stretching out against the wall, and the feeling of something important coming towards me. "I'm going back to Nairobi," I told him after we'd been quiet for a long time. "I'll leave with Tom in the morning. I'm going to take up flying again."
"I wish I saw the point in it," my father said.
I'd obviously surprised him, and though I didn't know if "it" meant aeroplanes or leaving Malela, I said, "Come up in Tom's plane one day. Maybe then you'll see." He'd been reading the Black Stud Book, his longtime Bible. His fingers caressed the spine for a moment, and then he shook his head.
"I know where I'm meant to be."
"I do too," I told him, and the minute the words left my mouth, I knew they were true.
"What should we do with the horses?"
"I'm not sure at the moment. They're Mansfield's too, after all. It might be years before our divorce is settled. But however all of that turns out, I want to earn my own living. I need to know I can take care of myself."
"You can do that flying?"
He sounded incredulous. "Maybe. Tom says one day aeroplanes will ferry people far and wide, as ships do now. I could be part of that. Or transport mail and parcels. Or, I don't know. Dennis had a scheme about scouting for hunters from above." It was the first time I'd said his name aloud since the day of his funeral. Even though my throat ached, it also felt right to call Dennis into this room. He was the reason I'd thought of flying for myself at all.
"It's awfully dangerous. I know I don't have to tell you that."
He stared into his coffee, thinking quietly.
"But you've never been afraid of anything, have you?"
"I have, though," I said, surprised at my own emotion. "I've been terrified. I just haven't let it stop me." It was quite late by that point, and we were both too tired to say anything more. I kissed him on the forehead, wishing him good night. But as I settled myself in bed, no matter how drained and exhausted I felt, there was a strange kind of energy pulsing through me, too. Thoughts appearing more plainly than they had in many years. Malela wasn't safe. It would more than likely dissolve one day, as Green Hills had. Pegasus would die, as Bulla had. Both of them my earliest heroes. My father would drift away, little by little, or all at once. Great rocking changes would come again and again. And I would survive them the way I had long ago, when my mother had boarded a train and become smoke.